Hallo, so schön, dass du da bist hier beim Podcast Happy, Holy and Confident, dein Podcast fürs Herz und den Verstand. Mein Name ist Laura Marlina Seiler und ich bin hier, um dich auf deinem spirituellen Weg zu begleiten, dich zu empowern, dich zu unterstützen und dich natürlich auch immer viel mit in mein Leben zu nehmen und all die Dinge, die bei mir so passieren, die sich verändern und der Mensch, zu dem ich immer mehr werde und werde. Und darum geht's hier. Also herzlich willkommen, so schön, dass du da bist. Ich freue mich riesig, ich hoffe, es geht dir gut. Und heute wartet hier im Podcast auf dich ein so cooles Interview mit einem so coolen Typen. Und zwar ist das Dr. Stephen Lawrence und Professor Dr. Stephen Lawrence. Und Stephen ist international anerkannter belgischer Neurologe und Neurowissenschaftler. Er ist auch Autor und Keynote-Speaker und er leitet die Coma Science Group an der Universität in Lüttich. Und er ist spezialisiert auf die Funktion des Gehirns bei Patienten mit schweren Bewusstseinsstörungen. Und er untersucht, und genau darum geht es hier in dem Interview eben, auch die Auswirkungen von Meditation und Nahtoderfahrung auf unser Bewusstsein. Also super spannend. Er ist mit ganz vielen Preisen auch schon ausgezeichnet worden und ist Autor von dem Buch »Warum Meditation heilt«. Und ich spreche mit Stephen darüber, wie wir Spiritualität, Meditation, Heilung und Bewusstsein aus der wissenschaftlichen Perspektive betrachten können. Also für alle, die immer sagen, oh, das ist ja alles totaler Quatsch und so weiter. Dieses Interview könnte diese Meinung durchaus verändern, wieso Meditation die mentale und körperliche Gesundheit stärkt und wie wir es für uns nutzen können, dass unser Gehirn die Fähigkeit hat, sich zu verändern. Neuroplastizität hast du bestimmt auch schon mal gehört und welche wissenschaftlichen Erkenntnisse es zu Nahtoderfahrungen gibt und wie das Auflösen von Glaubenssätzen tatsächlich im Gehirn abläuft. Also mega, mega spannend. Das hier ist wirklich ein Interview für all die, für die manche andere Folgen von mir vielleicht manchmal ein bisschen zu spirituell sind im Sinne von nicht wissenschaftlich genug. Das ist jetzt wirklich für alle Wissenschaftler unter euch und alle, die gerne Zahlen, Daten, Fakten haben wollen. Aber gleichzeitig ist die Folge auch wirklich für dich, wenn du einfach Spiritualität liebst, persönliche Weiterentwicklung liebst und es spannend findest, das Ganze mal aus einer wissenschaftlichen Perspektive belegt zu bekommen. Also ganz viel Freude mit diesem Interview und bevor es losgeht, denk dran, Mitte August beginnt dann mein neuer, wundervoller, kraftvoller Online-Kurs Heart Wide Open, wo es darum geht, dich wieder der Liebe in deinem Leben zu öffnen und wo du dich dann auch auf die Warteliste schreiben kannst. Die Links findest du alle in den Shownotes. Ich freue mich, wenn wir da sehen und wünsche dir jetzt ganz viel Spaß mit dieser Folge und welche Auswirkungen Meditation auf das Gehirn hat. Viel Spaß! I am so excited, happy, and grateful to have you on the show here today. Thank you so much for your time and being here.
Thank you so much, Lara. And congrats with the wonderful work you do. And it's a pleasure to be at the podcast here.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah, same to you. And so before we started the recording, I already told you that I'm so grateful for your work because I think it's so important that we also look at spirituality, at meditation, at healing, at consciousness, not only like from a spiritual feeling level, but also from a scientific level and to get data and to look at the brain and see what it does. So maybe we start with that. So when was the moment maybe you looked at a brain scan during a meditation and you went like, wow, like this is amazing. What has there been a moment like this where you just felt like, yeah, there is scientific to meditation, but there is science to meditation?
Yes, I do think, and that's what I want to summarize in the book, that meditation, it's no longer, you know, I believe in it or I don't believe in it. It's backed up by science. And for us, of course, an eye-opener, Lara, was when we had this these Buddhist monks, and one of them was Mathieu Ricard. He's the translator of the Dalai Lama. Mm-hmm. And he, 70 plus, he came to my lab and seeing his brain and measuring it and then comparing it, you know, for the past 25 years, we've been studying the mind and brain and we can do all these, you know, measures of the gray matter and seeing that he was like, 10, 15 years younger, neurologically speaking, was indeed, an eye-opener. And with the team, we decided we need to increase our efforts translate it also to the clinic, because I'm a neurologist, I'm a caregiver who is now prescribing meditation. So yes, I do think that Mathieu Ricard is one of those people who changed the way our team looked at something that for some is esoteric, fluffy, like meditation.
Can you maybe take us a little bit deeper into the science here? Because I think it's really interesting. What could you see in the brain? You said you saw that he's like 15 years younger than he would be supposed to be from the number of his age. So what did you see? How could you see that? And how was his brain maybe different? And also, maybe you can tell a bit, how much does he meditate? Does he meditate daily? Does he have a certain meditation he does?
Well, his life is very different from yours and mine, right? Mm-hmm. He's a monk. He's a Buddhist. And my wife says, you know, it's easy for him, you know, give him a full-time job, and I'm having 5 kids and you know, a lot of things going on. So how do you do that? He has over 60,000 hours of meditation.
Wow.
Behind him.
Wow.
And living in Nepal, going for retreats in the Himalaya, we saw many other monks. Their life cannot be compared to ours. Yet, I think we can learn from them. And for me as a scientist, taking the extreme, of course, is useful. And what did we see? Well, let me share it with you.
Yes.
You can see for yourself. This is the brain of Buddhist monk Mathieu Ricard, printed in 3D.
Wow.
And you can measure this. And in the book, you will see when we look inside, we see not just that this is a 3D print from his structural MRI, billions of brain cells. And more specifically, there are parts important in attention that are just more developed, which makes sense, because meditation, it's training your attention, right? Keeping your focus, doing one thing. You can do breathing meditation. You can also have open presence, be very aware of what's happening around you. And then you can train compassion, loving kindness. So depending on the exercise you do, you would see those different networks. That's what the science shows. It's a little bit like sport, right? You start running, get strong legs, start swimming, strong shoulders. Here it's more difficult. You would need those brain scans to be able to see inside. But I think that's really what the science shows. And it's not that just the brain cells, the gray matter. I have another print here. Let me take that for you. Maybe you're not used to see this. This is the inside. So this is the white matter. So these are the thousands of billions of brain connections. And again, so this is a 3D of Mathieu Ricard brain. And the left and the right hemisphere are just showing increased structural connectivity, meaning the number of tracts, like the, you know, these are like compare it with more tracts that connect both sides of your brain, and a better connected brain is a more efficient brain. So these are the things we saw in the monks, but we also see them if you and I, we start meditating. Already after 8 weeks, we can visualize the effects with these machines, these brain scanners, MRI, and others.
Wow, that's amazing. I mean, this is so, I think it's so great that you can show it, that you can really see it, and that it changes something in the brain. And this is also, maybe you can talk a little bit about the capability of the brain to change. I mean, this is something also that is amazing, right? It's not something fixed, and once you have the brain, it just stays the way it is, but it's like a living thing that changes in the way you treat it. Maybe we can talk about this as well a bit.
Absolutely. I think that's the field of neuroplasticity, because with the team, we treat patients who have damaged brains, right? I founded the Coma Science Group, so we have patients from all over Europe coming over because they take more time to recover after a severe traumatic brain injury or cardiac arrest survivors. So that's what we've been studying with all these brain scans, that yes, your brain cells, your brain connections, they change, and not only after a brain disease or after a traumatic brain injury. People listening and following this podcast, if you remember anything from it, it will change those thousands of billions of brain connections. And you're absolutely right. We should see this. This is something that changes all the time. And we can do something about it. So that gives us a possibility, I would even say a responsibility to, take better care of our mental well-being and the continuous stream of thoughts and perceptions and emotions. And that's also what I often hear from patients when they come and they have chronic pain or insomnia or depression, anxiety, burnout, whatever. And they would say, well, you know, it's in our family. We are such or so. And that's only partly true. We now know that even at the level of your gene expression, right, your environment and your psychology, your thinking is influencing how these genes express. It's the field of epigenetics. So that's clear now. And techniques like meditation are just one way to pay attention to what's happening between our ears and maybe not wait till we are in trouble, because that's what I see as a caregiver. We wait until we have a medical issue. And I think we could and should more invest in preventive use of those powers of the mind, if you want.
What are preventive things we can do to take care of our brain and of our cells, and how can we use neuroplasticity in our own favor?
Well, it's not just meditation. I think it's taking care of our lifestyle, hygiene. It's we mentioned sport and meditation is a kind of mental sport, but of course, taking care of our physical body and probably I spend a lot of time behind screens and I should move more. And that's as important, what we eat, the quality of our sleep, the quality of our relationships. So I think all of that, it's not rocket science. It really is important that we take good care of our mind, brain, body. These interactions are very complex, but even at the level of the immune system, we just had the COVID crisis, very, very challenging. But we do know that you can be so stressed out that you compromise your immune system. And the reverse is also true. You can, through, you know, learning how to deal with stress differently, have a positive impact also there.
When we talk about consciousness, what would you say from a scientific perspective, what is consciousness? Can you even define it? Is it possible?
Well, of course, as a clinician, I'm supposed to know what I mean when I say the patient is unconscious at the emergency or intensive care. And yet, as a scientist, I'm in a good position to know that our ignorance is just huge and we cannot explain consciousness. It's one of the biggest mysteries, like the origin of matter, the origin of life, the origin of consciousness is something that you know, will be a couple of Nobel Prizes before we maybe get there. And yet technology, brain imaging permitted us to identify networks. Let me maybe take another brain to show you what with the lab over the past 25 years we could identify. So this is just a plastic brain, but you see in blue what we call the external awareness network. So this in the front, both hemispheres, and in the back seems to be critical for you to be aware of your environment, everything you hear and see and feel. And then there's another part to consciousness, which is your internal awareness, right? These thoughts, you're talking to yourself probably right now. You can anticipate the future. You can learn from your own past, doing mental imagery. And that seems to critically depend on no opening the brain. And you have, again, the front and the back. And that is the internal awareness network. So, yes, we do know some parts of the brain that are more important than others. And it's useful, again, to translate that to clinical reality. And yet the big question, how do I get from something material as a brain to something subjective as my thoughts, perceptions, and emotions? Well, it's just incredibly, after 25 years of study, I'm just, looking at it and impressed and aware of my limited understanding and feeling very little.
But would you then, is it so that when you're a scientist that, and it's just impossible to explain something, do you then start to believe in something bigger, like that there is something that creates life? Or I just wonder how, what is happening then inside of you as a scientist when you just, you cannot explain it. So what is happening then?
Yeah, no, I think it would be quite arrogant to think we can explain everything, right? So I think I'm very happy that we understand a little bit better nature, what's happening around us, inside. Because not so long ago, in Europe and other countries, we were blaming witches when something went wrong, and we've been burning poor women, considering them as possessed or whatever. So understanding, in my case, neurological diseases, I think it's very, very useful. And yet, at one point also, there's this, you realize that some things are just bigger than us. And for me, it's important to separate, well, here I act as a clinician and I need to make decisions when working in intensive care. Here I'm the scientist questioning everything. And that's our job, to push the boundaries of knowledge and reduce a little bit our ignorance. And here I am as a human being, as a husband, daddy, who's watching the stars above, and we understand a little bit about astrophysics, but what can we say about where it all comes from? And that makes you humble, and it's also personally been a trajectory. I'm, of course, as a clinician, not prescribing meditation, as a spiritual experience. I'm not a priest or a philosopher or whatever. But personally, yes, I think it's a challenge, and how we find meaning in everything and find that right balance. It's also a little bit the personal story I tell in the book. But that's how we currently, with the team, try to approach it, to test our hypothesis, what we think we understand with what we think to measure, and in the same time, don't have the scientific arrogance to say, okay, we understand this, because that would be very far from the truth.
Do you have your own meditation practice or your routines that help you to stay aligned and healthy?
Yes, I think the philosophy of the book is really you do what you can. And it's wonderful if you can make this into some routine. And my good friend, the Buddhist monk, Mathieu Ricard, and thanks to him, I met a couple of times the Dalai Lama, and these are very inspiring people, but their life is very different. And so they would say, well, you know, every morning, 20 minutes, every evening, 20 minutes, just take the time. You can decide this, but let's take this morning, Laura. So Seth, there's five kids, two very young ones. My wife is having a full-time job, and it's just chaos. I cannot tell her, oh, bye, I'm going to sit on my cushion for 20 minutes. It will not work. So how do you do that? I think you can, in the beginning, discover a couple of exercises, and there's a couple of simple examples in the book. You can go on a retreat. One moment you need to leave your cushion and come back from the retreat. And then what do you do in real life when there's your job and, you know, you need to pay the bills and everything's, there's a lot of expectations from many people. So I believe that we can, through informal meditation and the way we interact with each other, at least that's how I experienced it. You can do it in a more mindful way. And I now meditate personally in the hospital, for example, confronted with these very, very difficult situations people go through after they have a loved one in intensive care. Just between two families, two consultations, I take a break and I would just pause, breathe, and that works for me. And the same when I'm in an argument with my wife or whatever, it's possible to deal with some challenges in life in a different way. Mm-hmm. And I think we can do some exercises. As you said, the brain is not, you know, something that's fixed. We can change the way we react. And that is a very personal journey. I think there's many ways to do that. So my favorite would be breathing meditation currently.
Mm. Yes. You said that you also treat coma patients. And I can imagine that sometimes there are patients that have something which is called a near-death experience. So people that kind of leave their body and they come back. Did you have this experience as well with patients that had a near-death experience?
Yes, thank you for bringing that up. We actually have a couple of projects specifically on the topic of near-death experiences, which is extraordinary. And again, I don't think I should be, you know, too arrogant. I never had one of them, so I should just shut up and listen to the people who tell me these extraordinary stories. And again, I think we underestimated what's going on in the mind of brain of people who, after cardiac arrest or trauma, they don't react to our questions and they look unconscious, but sometimes more is going on. So we have now hundreds of these testimonies. We published a number of papers trying to describe what these people feel. First of all, they tell us it's like a feeling of bliss, peacefulness. Many have these out-of-body experiences. And then we try, of course, to understand that. And maybe, Laura, I can use your podcast and the many people who listen to this to ask them to share their experience. If there's anyone listening who had such a near-death experience in a life-threatening situation or in other conditions, because we also had people who were meditating who had this or in very different conditions. So share it. There's the email, which is NDE from Near Death Experience, NDE at U Liège from University Liège .be. You will make our scientists happy and be part of the database. because there's a lot of books and a lot of, you know, Hollywood movies and not a lot of science. So we want to change that. And therefore, we need your testimonies. So
yeah,
thanks for bringing that up.
I will put the email address also in the show notes. So anybody who has an experience who wants to share, you find the email in the show notes. What I find so interesting, because I'm very excited about near-death experience, because it's to all the people I talked who had one, I didn't have one myself, but to all the people I had one, and they don't know each other, they all say something similar. What I think is really interesting, you know, that it's all... they all go to what you said, to this place of bliss and light and love, and they actually want to stay there. They don't want to, in most cases, they didn't want to come back. So I think this is really interesting, right?
Yes, and I agree that this is something that is universal. We have testimonies from all over the planet, from all time, even if now with modern intensive care, we see more of these patients who survive and can tell us what it was like. And yet there seem to be some differences. When I give lectures and conferences in Russia, that was before the war, a good friend of mine who is a priest, Father Shergai in St. Petersburg, he said, well, Stephen, you know, you say that in your cohort, they all, or 90% of them, experience this feeling of well-being. That's not what I hear from them. Half of them tell me they see the devil and they go to hell and they have bad trips, you know, they have negative near-death experiences. So that's actually a current research project, trying to understand what are the cultural differences. You mentioned the light, which very often would be interpreted as a kind of tunnel. In the West here. But when I'm in India, we collaborate with hospitals there, or in Muslim countries, it's this light that is not experienced as a tunnel, but more as a river or as a door, depending again on where you grew up. So this is still anecdotal currently, needs more, you know,
science.
Yeah. More science. So that's exactly why we try to have more testimonies and understand how is this universal phenomenon maybe also culturally different.
Interesting. Really interesting. Didn't know that. I also work as a coach, and very often I experience that people have limiting beliefs. So they told themselves a thought over and over and over again until they believed it and they didn't question the belief anymore. So from the scientific perspective, can you maybe talk a little bit about what is happening in the brain when we with beliefs in general, either negative or positive, but how we can also, once we implemented a negative belief about something like I'm not good enough, or I cannot do this, or the world is a bad place, like things like this. How can we rewire our brain in a way that we create a mindset that is healthy and helpful and nourishing for ourselves?
Well, so I showed you this 3D print of the connections in our brain. And that's just the representation, because reality is not something static like this. Reality is that you can change those connections. And we can be very, very good in repeating over and over some thoughts. You mentioned I'm not good enough, or because thoughts, even pain or anger, or they come and go, right? Studying thoughts and perceptions and emotions for 25 years now, with all these brain scans and machines, we never ever saw something that was just always there. So it comes, and then what it seems we're quite good at is that we would repeat it. So if I'm angry because some colleague said something, and you know, I've got an emotion, but then it goes away and I bring it back and again and again. And by doing that, I strengthen those connections. So that's a reality. But, you know, you can have an impact, and then you can strengthen that link, and the same power of the mind, you can also use it positively. And that is, for example, meditation and compassion and loving kindness. And it is realizing and actually doing the exercise that you decide. I can do otherwise. And of course, as a coach, that's what you see, that's what you do, is to empower people and to see how the little link between brain regions that gives me always the same, you know, response. Well, we can change that. That's the field of positive psychology, and it is again backed up by science. You can really see those changes, and it's extremely powerful. Again, we can learn from the monks, but we don't definitely no need to become a Buddhist or whatever Zen master. Each and every one of us can do that, and after 8 weeks of training, you would already see effects and feel the effects. So the brain is dynamic, extremely complex, but you can, through your own thoughts, change the way you are wired, so to speak.
That's amazing. So would you say, if I understand that correctly, that from a scientific perspective of the brain, once we repeat a thought and the feeling, it gets like an autobahn. I don't know how
it's like. Absolutely.
Like a road, a very well built road, and so it comes quicker, probably, right? So it gets triggered more quickly. So whenever you see that colleague, like, and you had this thought very often, the feeling comes quicker, and you get like kind of addicted to it, maybe like in a chemical way, right? That you right away go into that emotion because you trained your brain all the time. So is it good to that you once first you become aware that this is how it is, that you like build this anger highway in your brain, and that you can like destruct it in by stopping, getting aware, stopping, and then taking the detour down the highway and go up to another highway of good thoughts and good feelings? Is that a way that would help the brain to rewire?
Absolutely. As you just mentioned, so the first step is to become aware. Okay, this is going on, and then the rest is training, and also be kind to yourself, because this is there's not always a quick fix. So sometimes we start doing something, being meditation or something else, and then we say, okay, where's the result? And you know, there's no Olympics for meditation. It's rather, you know, I let go. We try this out and trust that this will be okay. Very difficult. And a question I often have is, you know, what do I need to do and how long do I need to do it? And then when will I, you know, see a difference? And maybe that's not the best approach. It's just to be more kind towards yourself or towards your coach, and try these different strategies out, because that can be different. You know, if you take a pill, if I prescribe a pill as a neurologist, it's quite easy, and also for the patient to just swallow. What you're talking about is this you know, discovery of how I can deal with stressors or conditions in a different way, but that is also partly personal, and so there's different strategies, and that's why in the book I don't like to see meditation as just one way, right? Even now it's quite Buddhist oriented, and that's wonderful, but it's not the only you know, possible tradition. You see here, the background is actually what I see through my window now, because I'm in Canada. And I'm here also partly because I'm connecting with the ancient traditions here of the Native mm-hmm. Americans. And they're very different. You see the very cold Saint Laurent River in front of me, where we would go bathing in the ice, which is also a form of meditation. And there's a number of very, very interesting things. Also, the way they interact with nature, mm-hmm. I think, is very inspiring. So that's I think the challenge to. Mm-hmm. Like in the sushi bar, I try something, I like it, I take more. If not, it's not for me.
You let it pass by. You let it go. What is your definition of spirituality? Do you believe in something higher and bigger? Or maybe what does spirituality mean to you? As a scientist, or a human being.
I'm Belgian, Flemish, raised Christian, went to Catholic school, then went to university, which was in Brussels, anti-religious atheist university, and then switched to, if I can't measure it, it doesn't exist, and it's science who will tell me what to do. And now I'm at a stage where I'm trying to find the right balance. Mm-hmm. So as said, there's many things that as a scientist, I'm trying to understand the human mind that we ignore with the current state of affairs. I do not believe in a personal God. I do believe in the power of the mind and the importance to sit down and contemplate. And I've seen Lara, many people die in my job, confronted with traumatic brain injury. I personally do not believe in a life after death as it is described in most religions, including Buddhism and reincarnation. But I do believe in something bigger indeed, which I'm currently struggling to put names on it, but that is kind of the equilibrium I'm currently looking for. And I think as a scientist, and I went to university, I did my PhD, I've spent a lot of time accumulating knowledge. And I think in our educational system, it is still very much knowledge oriented. Huh? And even, our big philosophers, Descartes, je pense donc je suis. Cogito ergo sum, I think, therefore I am. And I think maybe that's only part of the, what matters. It's also I experience, therefore I am. And that is something that we've been neglecting maybe too much and where I felt frustrated that there's this huge difference between what I knew from the books and what, I felt. And that's something I think, again, in our in schools, we should invest more in emotional well-being, and that's why I accepted to write the book. That's why, as a scientist, respectful scientist, I hope and believe I can make my little contribution to build a bridge in my field between classical medicine and the power of the mind. I don't like the term alternative medicine because I think it's complementary. I think we should use both approaches, and also in science. I think it's extremely challenging for us to objectively measure subjectivity, which is the human mind. And yet I refuse to say it's impossible. My favorite philosopher, Laura, is James Bond. Never say no. So at least let us try.
It's beautiful. Thank you for sharing. I have one last question I ask all of my podcast guests. So imagine you live a really, really long, beautiful life. You get really old, but you feel really young because you meditate so much. and everything is amazing in your life. But one day there comes the last day of your life, and I would come to you and I would say, Stephen, I'm so sorry, but everything got deleted. Your books got deleted, your research got deleted, everything is gone. But I do have a white sheet of paper and a pen. And you could write on this white sheet of paper three wisdoms, three things that you would like or love people that stay behind to remember and to live by. What would you write down?
Oh, gosh, that's terrible. What I would like, I have no problem, you know, to be deleted. And I'm very much aware that I'm just a very, very small piece in the big picture. I would wish my kids and everyone to remain curious. I think curiosity is key, and to question your own truths. So you see, I still a little bit remain the scientist saying, you know, be curious, question, and challenge the truths of the day. And love, of course. I mean, we mentioned the difference between knowledge and feelings. And so how can we explain love? It's, I think, for me, then more important to emphasize those values than you know, any encyclopedia wisdom.
Thank you for sharing. Thank you so much. Beautiful. Thank you. So your book, Warum Meditation Heilt in German, is available everywhere for whomever wants to dive deeper into it. Maybe you can say one, two sentences about the book, what people find in the book, and what it can help for to read it.
So the book is a summary of my little personal journey and how through a crisis I started to meditate and met Mathieu Ricard, and that became a scientific project. So I summarize what we know and do not know about science, the brain, but also the body, and how as a clinician I now use it, and how the clinical trials show us that this is powerful. It can be as powerful as antidepressants, anxiolytics, painkillers. So these are just facts that I wanted to share with the biggest possible number. It's very accessible, translated now in 10 languages, Laura. Wow. So also for the English-speaking audience, Bloomsbury, they made the Harry Potters. So now
amazing.
The no nonsense meditation book is out in, I would say, all major languages. And it's about, you know, sharing what I learned about the power of meditation and its impact on our brains. Written for skeptics, because that's what I was. I was very happy to write it and to offer some simple exercises that I enjoyed, and hopefully others who discover this book. And I'm very, very happy that you give it
space, room.
Room, yeah. In the German-speaking world, because my German is nicht so good. Aber vielen, vielen Dank.
My Flemish neither. Stephen, thank you so much for your work. Thank you so much for having the scientific point of view on this topic, because I think it's so valuable and important to also have this part and to take it out of this woo-woo corner into reality, and to talk about it and to show that it does make a difference when we meditate, and it helps the brain and helps ourselves to stay healthy. So thank you so much for everything you do. Thank you so much for making us understand our beautiful brains and to use it better. And thank you for everything you do. Thank you for the amazing conversation and everything you said. The links are in the show notes. So thank you and all the best for you.
Thank you so much. And if there's any further question, please contact us through the different channels. Do what we can to answer all your questions and take very good care. Thank you so much for this wonderful discussion, Lara.
Thank you.
Willkommen zurück und ich hoffe, ja, dass dieses Interview dir wahnsinnig gut gefallen hat. Du bist vielleicht genauso wie ich so ein bisschen, vielleicht bist du genauso wie ich so ein kleiner spiritueller Nerd und findest es einfach auch mega geil, dich mit der wissenschaftlichen Seite von dem ganzen Thema zu beschäftigen und hast vielleicht in dem Interview nochmal ein paar Sichtweisen mitbekommen, die dir helfen, auch wirklich aus wissenschaftlicher Perspektive zu sehen und zu verstehen, wie wirkungsvoll Meditation ist und auch Persönlichkeitsentwicklung. Also danke, dass du da bist. Danke, dass du zugehört hast. Teil die Folge natürlich gerne mit allen, die du kennst und wo du denkst, ja, vielleicht würde er oder sie diese Folge auch feiern oder gut finden. Und wie immer hast du die Möglichkeit, bei mir heute auf Instagram @LauraMarlinaSeiler unter dem Post von heute zur Podcast-Folge ein wunderschönes Happy, Holy and Confident Notizbuch zu gewinnen und ein Shirt von Rock On und Namaste, ein Happy, Holy and Confident Shirt, die so schön sind, meine absoluten Lieblingsshirts. Also hüpf rüber, mach mit und ich freue mich, wenn wir da voneinander hören. Und dann Mitte August beginnt mein neuer Online-Kurs zum Thema erfüllte Partnerschaft und Beziehung, Heart Wide Open. Ich freue mich auf dich, fühl dich von Herzen umarmt. Rock On und Namaste, deine Laura.